You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll hear about the closure of one of Sioux City's oldest department stores. Sears operated in Siouxland for 90 years, and it closed over the weekend. But first, an update on tax assessments. Tax assessments should be arriving in the mail for Sioux City residents next Friday, and there could be some sticker shock for commercial property owners. Residential owners can expect to see a 10% jump on average, but commercial owners could pay as much as 35% more. Under state law, city and county assessors must reset valuations every 2 years, between 95 and 105% of the fair market price. Local sales, new construction, and changes to individual parcels also play a part in assessing a property's value. Sioux City Assessor John Lawson says big rises in commercial property assessments can happen when the property gains in value, but the assessments have lagged behind.
Based on sales, okay, we look at sales for residential properties, we look at sales for commercial properties, we look at sales for the multi-residential apartments. All are required to be market value. So when you look at the sales, if the sales are running, in other words, our median on residential was about 88%. So to get to 100% market value, we have to raise values somewhere in that 10% range. We can be between 95 and 105%, but we're supposed to raise them, you know, to market value. Our ratio for commercial currently is at 69.2. So when a property is selling, what that's saying is that we need to raise about 35% over that value to get to the sale prices that are happening in the market.
Some of these raises maybe should have been done. It's sort of a big, seems like a big step, but maybe some of this should have been done before.
Yes. When I got here, basically, the previous assessor was not necessarily doing the job properly. Especially on the lower end commercial properties, instead of raising them, you know, 10 or 20% like they needed to be, he was raising the larger properties enough to cover the difference. And so, you know, it's real easy to raise, like a Target store, $1 million, where it's hard to raise 100 small development buildings or whatever in an area of town, $10,000 a piece to get that same value.
So are we talking about areas like downtown and also, I believe, Sunnybrook with all the new buildings?
I mean, what we found was first thing we wanted to do was land. We found land along Hamilton Boulevard, along Sunnybrook Drive, along Singing Hills, along Sergeant Road, and stuff, pretty much everywhere in town, really, that, I mean, there were massive increases that had never been dealt with on land sales. So first thing we did was adjusted the land. Then we went and looked at the buildings. And again, tried to get to market value on the properties. But there will be some properties that went up, you know, more than 35%. There's going to be some that didn't go up 35%. So, but that's an average.
And so some people might have a little sticker shock, or would they be expecting it?
I would think if you bought the building, you know, for say $1 million, and we only have $660,000 on it, that would tell you that the market value is much more than what the assessment is. But yeah, it's probably going to be sticker shock for them, because everyone, they get that in their minds that I guess the assessments, you know, aren't always 100% of the market. So when we have to catch up like this, it becomes a huge deal.
Well, I know a few years ago when some assessments, especially on residential property, were hiked, there were a lot of people saying that they were going to protest and they were going to file appeals. But from what I gathered, not as many people filed appeals as said that they might. Are you expecting to have some appeals this time around?
I would expect a lot of appeals, but the biggest thing that I'm trying to, I would like people to come in. We have, by sending our notices out next Friday, we've given them 2 weeks in the month of March that they can come into our office, and basically we can talk over their property or whatever. And if there is an issue with the value, we can lower it. It also, there's now an informal protest period from April 2nd to April 25th that if people come in during that time frame, that we can again talk about it, but we have to have, they have to agree upon the change in value at that point. So it becomes if I believe that, maybe it was 3 or 4% more than what it should be, but they still think the value should be less than that, then I can't change that value unless they agree to it. And then they have to file an appeal and go through the appeal process. I'm hoping that we can do a lot of this, I guess, understanding that I can show them sales that have taken place. This is what your property, is. It would sell similar to this, and if we have misinformation, we want to correct it. I think on commercial properties, if they look at the market, they're going to see that the market has gone up quite a bit in the last few years, and not a lot has changed in assessed values during that time. So.
So their properties are worth more. They could ostensibly sell for more.
Understanding the fact that the assessor is only here to put a fair and equitable value on every property. It's not that the city needs more tax dollars or I'm trying to get more tax dollars for the city. It's simply that by law I'm required to try and put every property at what the market value is. If I don't do that, in the fall, the Department of Revenue comes in, and what they will do is they would have put a like a 35% increase on every commercial property. Everyone would get the exact same value. Well, everyone knows that in a market as big as Sioux City, not every property is going to change the exact same percentage the exact same time.
That was Sioux City Assessor John Lawson talking about tax assessment increases that will be arriving in Sioux City residents' mailboxes next Friday. Residential assessments could go up as much as 10%, but because of a lag in assigning value to some commercial properties, those properties could increase as much as 35% in some cases. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This past weekend, the doors closed at the Sears store at the Southern Hills Mall after the company had been a part of the Sioux City community for more than 90 years. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer recently spoke with a local economist to get his insight on the retail issues faced by the longtime retailer and his prediction for the future of the American Mall. Here's part of her conversation with J. Jeffrey Zink, Associate Professor of Economics at Morningside College.
Kind of mixed feelings. On the one hand, I'm kind of sad to see it go. I knew it employed a lot of people. I know it was an American icon, and I know it was an innovator in a lot of ways for a lot of its history. But recently you could tell that there was a slide going on, or that there was something else going on. If you went to the Sears at the local mall here, you could see over the last 5 or 7 years that things just weren't going right. The stock that they had on the shelves wasn't that great. The store kept getting more bare as you went, each time you went in, until finally there was a point where I just didn't even bother to go in anymore because you just knew they wouldn't have what you needed.
What happened to Sears?
That's a really good question. On the one hand, it was a little bit behind when it comes to some of the retailing trends. And so Amazon caught a lot of people by surprise. There were some other things that went on. There are some demographic changes going on. But the other thing that might be going on is Eddie Lampert, its current CEO, is a controversial figure in the business world. He originally had the idea to buy Sears and thought he could turn it around, but he didn't have any background in retail, and he didn't have any idea how you could streamline Sears' online presence, which is a big deal now. And so there are people that said just because he didn't know that really wasn't his intention, that his intention was to come in and strip Sears of its assets and enrich himself.
It's kind of been the way of America lately, hasn't it?
You can certainly get that impression. The problem is that this happens to coincide with another possible explanation that Sears was just simply inefficient and had to die off. And that's, when you have changes in technology or changes in demographics or changes in the wider world, these things kill off firms that either don't keep up or who are producing an outmoded product, for example. I mean, you don't see too many carriage makers around anymore just because the car emerged. And so you have the same sort of problem in terms of Sears and how you get consumer products to consumers. People aren't driving much to the malls anymore, partially because there's fewer of them and partially because over the last 40 or 50 years there's been a definite change in terms of the distribution of income, more towards the poles. So you have some people that are very, very wealthy. You get a lot of people that are a lot more poor, and so that hollowed out the middle class, which was basically Sears' customer base.
Now, going back to the mall recently lost another anchor store in Yonkers. They've now lost Sears. You've briefly just mentioned this about the mall. What kind of future does the Southern Hills Mall have in your eyes?
Not a very bright one. Two of the three anchor stores are gone, and JCPenney's not in good financial shape either right now. They've closed several hundred stores over the past couple of years, and so I don't see them maintaining a presence very much. And so once all three anchor stores are gone, then I don't see much of a future for the Southern Hills Mall, and it will have to be, repurposed somehow. And I'm not sure what that's going to be. The problem is, or one of the problems is there's a huge amount of infrastructure there in terms of utility lines and things like that go in. And so, what do you do with that? You just don't want to let that sit around for a long time. And that also means there are other implications as a result of those stores leaving and a decrease in mall traffic that isn't necessarily picked up by other retailers. And that means a decline in tax revenues for the city.
So it kind of all goes together, doesn't it?
The knock-on effects are something that people often, miss. And so I use an example in some of my classes, and if you think about this, then it makes kind of sense. If you think about what the housing bubble does or did, and back in to the run up to 2008, it begins to inflate property values. Well, cities can look at that and say they can make the assumption, a very human one, that this sort of inflation is permanent, and so as a result, they find that they can maintain or increase their tax revenues by cutting taxes, but that's an extraordinary environment, and it doesn't usually work that way. And so what ends up happening is all of a sudden, when the bubble bursts and those property values crater or crash, then city tax revenues crater and crash. And so cities find after a while that, and counties and other local tax authorities find that they can't finance the services that they need to finance, and so there has to be service cutbacks, because so many of those places are operating under balanced budget amendments.
We could probably talk to you for hours about this topic, right?
Yes.
Now, going back to the Southern Hills Mall, what do you think can be done? And I know you mentioned people shopping online. When people go out there, they do see people. There's foot traffic out there.
And partially that has to do with people probably just needing to get out of the house sometimes during the winter and going to a sheltered place. That's one of the reasons why malls ended up killing off a lot of downtown shopping areas, as people found that it was a more comfortable, climate-controlled environment, and they didn't have to deal with snow, wind, whatever. And so some of the first things that ended up happening, it's not particularly surprising that some of the first totally enclosed indoor mall was in Minneapolis, built in 1956, and it was to get rid of the weather. And once that trend begins, then you begin to hollow out the downtown areas, and people begin to shop at the malls, and so that followed the population away from the downtown areas after World War II. So you built the suburbs, those people are going to demand amenities, they're going to be having, so, right, I mean, you know, 50s and 60s, it's what we consider to be the boom time in America, and so the income follows, and so the stores follow, they just take a different form. And now the demographics are changing again. That generation is dying off. The new generation is smaller and poorer, actually, because of the distribution of income that's happened over the past 50 years. And one of the things that ends up happening is they don't feel like they want to shop that way anymore because of the advent of e-commerce. So Amazon emerges and basically kills off the mall.
That was J. Jeffrey Zink, Associate Professor of Economics at Morningside College. Representatives from the Southern Hills Mall and parent company Washington Prime Group say they are exploring opportunities to redevelop the Sears space. They plan to make a future announcement about what they call a repositioning project for the mall. Last year, Washington Prime Group allocated between $100 and $125 million for redevelopment projects across the country. For more information, you can go to our website, kwit.org. Also, listen for a full story from Sheila Brummer during Morning Edition and All Things Considered tomorrow. Well, despite what's going on at the mall, other areas of Siouxland are going forward. Sioux City Council members have adopted plans for a multi-purpose venue that will host everything from farm shows to soccer tournaments to dog shows. As Katie Pikus reports, officials expect the center to draw people from throughout the region.
Siouxland Expo Board President Dirk Laurie showed off a scale model of the 104,000 square foot building to the council yesterday.
Observation deck.
Back into here, and we could put seating up here as well as down below. But I have to emphasize, we aren't really emphasizing spectator sports in this.
The project will cost nearly $13 million. It's been in the works for about a decade. Laurie says he hopes it could bring people from across Iowa and nearby states to Sioux City.
You know, if you put on a major farm show, people will come from the five-state region to come here. I just want anybody to come here, and rather than us going to Omaha or Sioux Falls, where they have similar facilities like this.
The project now goes out to bid. The city expects the building to open in summer 2020.
And that was Katie Pikus reporting. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, a group of leaders from the Association for Career and Technical Education visited college sites around Iowa where innovative programs are expanding educational opportunities outside of the traditional college curriculum. The group stopped by Western Iowa Tech Community College on Monday and learned about four of its career and technical programs that are in high-need areas of the economy. Jared Nagurka is the Advocacy and Public Affairs Manager for the ACTE. Nagurka says the WIT programs are helping to fill the skills gap.
The idea that industry and business have all these unfilled career positions but just need to make sure they have the skilled talent to fill those jobs, it's not uniquely an Iowa problem. It's a national problem that we're seeing in all pockets of the country. And so one of the reasons why we're so excited to be in Iowa today and this week is to see how some of these really innovative career and technical education programs, both at the secondary and post-secondary level, are helping prepare students for careers and for career success.
What are some of the programs you're going to be looking at today?
Sure. So today we're looking at the pharmacy technician, nurse aide, robotics, and video media production programs here at Western Iowa Tech Community College. And so these are all in high-need career areas. There are job vacancies in many different industries, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, health sciences. Those are some of the highest demand fields. And so students are getting a terrific education here, and they're being prepared for the workforce.
And some of them are fairly new, like the video and audio and the broadcasting program here, but they've had a lot of people want to get into it.
Absolutely. And one of the really unique things that we're seeing, and one of the things that we want to take to other programs across the country, is really modeling and synthesizing what are some of the needs in the local community and how can an education program help fill those needs. So whether it's working with local chamber of commerce and local industries, local businesses, to really identify what those needs are in the community and creating and implementing programs that fill those needs is a really important component of high quality career and technical education and something that's going on here.
Do you guys do anything with funding? Because often paying for those programs is the toughest thing for students.
Yes, so the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act, which at the federal level was just reauthorized as the Strengthening Career and Technical Education for the 21st Century Act, provides right around $1.3 billion to career and technical education programs all across the country, both at the secondary and post-secondary level. Last year, Iowa received around $12.5 million for these programs. And I know that a lot of the programs from equipment to professional development that we've seen have been funded through Perkins, and it's why we are advocating for doubling the federal investment in career and technical education over the next couple of years.
That was Jared Nagurka, the Advocacy and Public Affairs Manager for the National Association for Career and Technical Education Group. Members of ACTE toured Western Iowa Tech Community College on Monday and saw some different technical and career programs, including pharmacy technician. The Pharm Tech program is open to high school students, and one of them is Binyan Ware, a senior at Bishop Helan Catholic High School in Sioux City. Ware says he got into the program because he had an interest in pharmacy.
When I was looking to different careers that I might want to pursue in the future, pharmacy was one of the choices that I wanted to explore. And I talked to my counselor and said, hey, this might be something that I want to do in the future. And she said, well, there's a program at WIT that would help you see what you're going to be doing in a day-to-day basis, you know, in an actual pharmacy scene. And I said, hey, why not take that and see what I can gain from it and see if this is what I want to do in the future.
So how long have you been in the program?
A little over, since the beginning of senior year, so 6 months.
How has it been for you?
It's good. I think I learned a lot. Maybe some of the things that I wouldn't know, like day-to-day things that pharmacists do, counting pills, sterile compounding. We all know what a pharmacist does on the bigger picture, which is just dispense pills to patients, but there are a lot of things that go behind the scenes, and I think this program has helped me see what it is that goes on.
I guess finally, you're going to go to Creighton. What will your major be there?
My major is going to be international relations. I've always been, in love with helping my community and understanding what the best way to put my talents in action was. And I thought it was pharmacy, but after coming to this program and seeing how I would be impacting people, I chose to go the law direction instead of the pharmacy.
That was Binyam Ware, a senior at Bishop Helan Catholic High School, who is in the Western Iowa Tech Community College Pharmacy Tech program. Ware will be attending Creighton University in Omaha in the fall, studying pre-law. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Many of us have those days where we'd like to take a day off work to get away from the stress and strain of our jobs. But for many American workers, stress is just one manifestation of truly dangerous workplaces. In the book Dying to Work, author and attorney Jonathan Carmel raises our awareness of unsafe working conditions with accounts of workers who were needlessly injured or killed on the job. Carmel says he found out that even working at a grocery store or a hospital can pose significant dangers.
And that was one of the takeaways that I hope people would get out of the book, and certainly what attracted me to telling the stories and writing the book, was that it's just not coal miners underground, who are fewer and fewer these days in any event, but it is grocery stores are a very dangerous place. And these are workers that we come into contact with every day. And we don't think of them as being dangerous places. I was worked in a grocery store when I was 16. And it was dangerous then, and it remains a dangerous place to work today. Hotels are dangerous to the workers there as well. All sorts of workplaces that we don't normally associate with as having dangerous conditions, but they all do.
Are these dangerous conditions connected with the changing technology and automation? I hear a lot about that lately.
Some of it maybe. I think in the grocery stores, for example, when I was a kid in a grocery store, the cashiers, you know, punched keys on a cash register drawer. I don't know if you recall those days, sort of like the dial telephone that's no longer around.
And now
they're scanning the product across these UPC code eyes that read the UPC codes on the barcodes on the product. And just the repetitive motion of scanning the product across the grocery checkout belt causes enormous injuries to these workers in their arms and their shoulders, their wrists, their elbows, their backs from standing all day. And these employers know how to fix the problem, but since they're not mandated to do so, they choose not to.
Do you think that if you had stricter rules that this could be improved?
Yes, I think it's difficult, but not doesn't mean we can't keep trying to, but it's difficult to have a workplace rule or standard, as they call it, which tells employers and workers what is expected of their particular job and their particular workplace, what kind of standards should be followed in order to keep workers safe. Those are called regulations. And as you know, there is a huge anti-regulatory fever in this country, probably more so than it used to be, but it has been for certainly the last, since Ronald Reagan was president, there's been an anti-regulatory fever and all sorts of things, and workplaces have not escaped that. And so we have, it takes about 7 years on average to promulgate a single workplace regulation. And some of them, serious ones, for silica, for example, took over 18 years before they got a workplace regulation.
You talk in the book about, you know, how many people are now part-time or contingent workers. Does this play a part in this as well? Because it does seem like when people are part-time over years that they never quite get the same respect and attention that a full-time employee gets. I can't say that in all cases, but I've seen that.
Well, I think the move to a part-time workforce, which is particularly prevalent in lower-wage workers, these workforces tend to not be as regulated because they're just part-time workers. And it all has to do with sort of a calculation between the cost-benefit analysis of an employer and their, you know, the cost being the loss of productivity or the workers' compensation benefits that they have to pay them. So, that, you know, having a part-time workforce or a continuing workforce is certainly a problem. And these workers tend to be put out in the most dangerous jobs as well.
Are we talking the construction and those kinds of things?
In unionized construction or unionized workplaces in the construction industry, they're still unsafe workplaces, but they're more regulated either by union contract or just the fact that there's, you know, often health and safety committees that have been negotiated and they pay attention to the safety of their workplace. In non-union construction work sites, you often have a lot of workers who are not legal in this country. They don't have legal work status. You find that in the South and Southwest a lot. So these workers have no protections, and the employers don't pay attention to the health and safety conditions of these workers. They're the most vulnerable in the construction industry, and particularly in housing construction.
I have talked to a lot of people in the last, say, 5 years or so, and I've been interviewing people just through my own work. And I can't tell you the number of people I've met who have someone in their family who has been either permanently injured at work, unable to work from then on, constantly fighting some sort of workers' comp case, these things that never seem to get fully resolved.
Government numbers in terms of the number of workers who get injured and lose work time, lose days at work, is over 3 million a year. So it's not unlikely that someone's going to know somebody. There's going to be a LinkedIn kind of relationship there, if you will. And those are just the reported numbers. There's a lot of underreporting going on, deliberate underreporting by employers and disincentives that are put in place by employers to dissuade employees from reporting their workplace injuries to OSHA or to a state agency. So the numbers are out there that somebody is going to know somebody in a close to them or 2 degrees of separation. It's not a big separation there where they're going to know somebody who's been seriously injured and are now subject to the crazy quilt of workers' comp laws that we have in 50 states. We basically have 50 different workers' comp laws. And that's a very, very difficult thing for workers to deal with.
So this is a really big issue on several levels. And obviously there's can't be a one size fits all fix for it. But what do you think would be helpful to try and make the situation better for workers and, you know, also for companies? Because clearly, even though sometimes they don't want to spend the money on extra protections, it must cost them money in cases, in having to rehire different people and go through all this over and
government
over.
Government statistic, again, in terms of what it costs to the economy from injured and workers or injured workers who are killed at work is over $300 billion a year. So it affects the all the, you know, employers as well. In terms of there is no silver bullet, but I think something that would help, at least would help workers when they are injured, is to have a national workers' compensation standard rather than being at the mercy of whatever state you live in or the state you get injured in. You know, if you cross borders to go to work, it's so kind of haphazard. And the benefits available to workers when they get injured through the workers' comp system are really difficult to obtain. It was supposed to be when workers' compensation started, it was supposed to be you get injured at work, we're going to pay your lost time, and we're going to pay for your health. Medical costs. And now it's become an incredibly litigious system run by insurance companies who have a disincentive to pay and by state legislatures who set the workers' comp reimbursement rates in their individual states. And if you go to the state of Indiana's website on this, they brag about how low their workers' compensation reimbursement rates are as a way to say this is a good place for a business to come in, do business, relocate to Indiana where you don't have to pay workers' compensation benefits that you might have to pay in Illinois, for example. That's not a good thing.
That was author and attorney Jonathan Carmel, who wrote the book Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the Workplace. The book chronicles the dangers of all kinds of workplaces and the issues involved with workers' compensation, insurance, and medical treatment. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Many residents of Siouxland and the Iowa Great Lakes are focused on keeping the area around Lake Okoboji unpolluted and pristine. The Dickinson County Conservation Board has made some gains in that area by acquiring the former Brooks National Golf Club, which is right next to East Lake Okoboji. The executive director of the board, Lee Sorensen, says the golf course came up for sale less than a month ago, so the board moved quickly to buy it with the help of a generous anonymous benefactor who donated $3 million to the board.
And we were contacted and said if it was purchased, would we accept it as a gift? And we said absolutely. And things just went by really quick, and anonymous donor purchased it or donated money to our conservation foundation, and they actually ended up purchasing it under the conservation board's name.
Doesn't it also really help with the water quality issues up there?
Because anytime you have an development, like I said, you got people fertilizing lawns and you got bluegrass, which has no really filter system. Pieces that we have in native prairie actually helps the water quality because the root system filters the water going through the soil. So any parts that aren't used as the golf course will be put in prairie or get out of that Kentucky bluegrass mindset where we have a better filter system.
So what's going to happen now with the golf course now that you own it?
Well, our biggest questions right now is the golf course going to stay? Is kind of the basic response we got. And for this year, our goal is, yes, it will stay. And beyond that, we have not made any decisions on whether the golf course is going to be there or it isn't going to be there. That's kind of where the public comment comes in, and we do our due diligence to see how to move forward.
Does that happen later on this year? You guys are going to have that? Or?
We'll actually start that process with the snow still here until people can get out, and honestly for us to really get out and walk around the property and just kind of brainstorm on, you know, what could happen in the future. So it'll be throughout the summer that we'll be taking those notes and asking people's input for where this piece of property goes for a direction.
So it was always helpful to have it there.
Cool. You got your different levels of, you know, a native prairie is going to clean water better than your short grasses. It's on different levels for water clarity and cleanliness of water. Our real goal was the development, the reducing of commercial development or housing development. Yep.
Part of this, the donation, was it that that a conservation easement would be there? Is that what happened?
Correct. Yep. We have until November to get a conservation easement on the property. And what that easement will say is that there is no future commercial development or housing development placed on the land.
Well, that's a pretty big swath there, isn't it?
It is. It's 230 acres.
And land up around Okoboji is a pretty important thing, as we all know.
It just seemed like it was the right fit for us for conservation practices and being adjacent to our Kenyu Park area already. And so we've worked very close with the golf course in the past with Birding on the Greens and educational programs like that. So it just seemed to be a good fit.
So what's going to happen with the buildings that are there? Isn't there a restaurant there and a shop? And
yep, there's a restaurant, the pro shop, and then a couple small maintenance facilities. And right now, our goal is we're working on an agreement with the current management to operate the golf course as is for this year. And then through the summer, the conservation board will look at all their options and take public comment to see what's the best fit for the future of this property.
Are there any other things that you're looking forward to in terms of conservation up there that you're particularly interested in, or that you're, you know, particularly proud of in the last year?
Well, we're really working on, our pollinators is a huge program of ours to help the butterflies and the bees, because the pollinators are taking such a decrease in numbers. We just did our expansion of the Nature Center, our addition, which will be actually opening in November this year, our grand opening, with all our environmental education interactive displays to educate people on how to benefit pollinators and what can we do at home to increase the pollinators. So we're really pushing the pollinators because, you know, that relates to our food source, which is vital for all of us. And with their decline, we need to take the proper steps to enhance them and not decline them.
That was Lee Sorensen, the executive director of the Dickinson County Conservation Board, which has recently purchased a golf course next to East Lake Okoboji. And if you're up and around the Great Lakes area in Spencer in the next week or so, you might want to take in an exhibit about the Civil War. In March of 1861, Abraham Lincoln took office as the 16th President of the United States. The next month, the first shots of the Civil War sounded at Fort Sumter in South Carolina. And Spencer, Iowa, is remembering the veterans of this deadly conflict. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer traveled to Spencer to see this piece of American history.
Walking into a wing of the Clay County Heritage Center transports you to a time of turmoil for the United States, starting in April of 1861.
This new exhibit, it's called Boys in Blue, Grand Army of the Republic.
Stephanie Horsley is the director of the center, located in Spencer, Iowa. She shows us items on loan from a museum in Sioux Falls, plus some local additions.
It highlights what the Grand Army of the Republic was, and it was our country's first veterans organization for Civil War veterans. We have a lot of Civil War veterans that came to Clay County in the 1860s and beyond, 1870s and 80s.
When the Civil War ended in 1865, Spencer didn't exist. But the men who moved here made a mark.
So our area of Northwest Iowa and Spencer was fairly young during the Civil War era. And Spencer was officially a town in 1871, so it was still sparsely populated in Clay County. And so there weren't as many men that left from here to go to the war, but there were a lot of men who came after the war who settled in this area with land grants, and they just wanted to get away from, you know, where they used to be. They wanted to have a new start.
Director of Collections at Clay County Heritage, Braden Faleen, estimates the local cemetery is the final resting place for up to 115 soldiers of the Civil War, the bloodiest conflict ever fought on U.S. soil. 5 days after General Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant, an assassin took the life of President Abraham Lincoln.
Interesting enough, we have two soldiers who guarded Abraham Lincoln's coffin during his funeral procession. One guarded him in Pennsylvania and the other guarded him in Illinois. And they're both buried out in Riverside. So we kind of a neat story there of two veterans who kind of helped serve after the war of protecting Lincoln on his funeral train.
A Civil War soldier's chance of surviving the war, about 1 in 4. More than 618,000 people died at the end of the conflict, many fallen from disease, others from fighting on the front lines.
We have a small cannonball that would run fired, and then a 12-pound cannonball that would be fired out, the typical cannon you'd think of. We have a bayonet that would have been used during the time, a sword that was actually made in Germany and then sold to the army. We have Spencer rifles, which have no direct connection to Spencer, Iowa. They are created by Christopher Spencer, who was an arms developer during the Civil War era.
Boys in Blue, Grand Army of the Republic, also features biographies connecting generations.
We have a few of our veterans that we talk about. We also have kind of who their relatives are now. So like, for example, Joseph O'Brien, his great-grandson is David Symington, who is involved on the Clay County Fair Board. He's a banker locally, and so a great community involvement from descendants of veterans.
The director of the center, Stephanie Horsley, also shares a personal connection with this informative history lesson.
My husband's family have some personal memorabilia and artifacts from some ancestors that were in the Civil War, and a couple of them here include two letters that were written by Manasseh Reeves and his brother Van V. Reeves. And they are ancestors of my husband's mother, Maureen Reeves Horsley. You can see their fancy penmanship, and she was able to type them out. And so you can see what they talk about when they were fighting in Tennessee area.
A 4-year period of strife and death and new beginnings brought to life for a modern audience.
I think we could learn a lot by going back and learning about how that Civil War affected our country because of the repercussions that we see today.
In Spencer, Iowa, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
You can check out The Boys in Blue until May 25th at Clay County Heritage in Spencer. For a look at the exhibit, check out a video on our Siouxland Public Media webpage. Clay County Heritage will also be hosting a Civil War presentation Tuesday, March 26th from 4 to 5 p.m. It will feature Civil War reenactors with members of the Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War out of Atlantic, Iowa. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks to Sheila Brummer for her pieces this week. Be sure to join us next Wednesday afternoon, beginning at noon at the Sioux City Public Library, for a live discussion in person and on the air about the tariff wars between the U.S. and China. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.